It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. 100-year floods now happen every year. Wildfires spread where they never used to go. And in every case, when the storm and the TV cameras are gone, the people left behind face an agonizing choice. Do they stay or go? Rebuild or relocate? We have been asking that since Hurricane Katrina.
It raised questions about, one, how to recover, and two, how to grapple with the reality that it was likely to happen again.
I ain't going no place, man. I'm gonna stay right here. This is it. This is my home, and this is where I'll be.
The city made the decision to rebuild, but was it the right choice? That question haunts urban planner Brian Stone.
One of the lessons that we have from the Dutch, which is a full country that's mostly under sea level, is how, one, to defend with physical infrastructure, but two, how to accommodate the water that must and will periodically come in. That was one of the philosophies that was considered in the immediate aftermath through a commission appointed by the mayor. And so one of the strategies was to identify floodable spaces.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Mayor.
The challenge with this particular episode is that this commission made decisions of where to locate floodable parks, and they were locating the floodable parks in low elevation areas around New Orleans.
None of us want to be in this particular place.
Many of the residents are not even in the city at this point, and already proposals being floated to relocate residents. The other challenge here is that the lowest elevation zones in New Orleans are almost exclusively African-American neighborhoods.
Did any of these local politicians do anything for you?
No.
Have they done anything for you?
No.
You know, low elevation, high flood risk in many U.S. cities is going to be communities of color because of historic redlining and other disparities. And so there was a lot of pushback against this proposal, and ultimately it did not carry the day. The plan wasn't adopted.
You've been in the background trying to scheme and get out of the land. Just like your leader said, I'm gonna die on mine.
In the longer term view though, several of these neighborhoods have not recovered well in the intervening two decades. You know, only 80% of the population returned to New Orleans even today. The quality of life's not particularly high. In some cases, you don't have cultural centers, great access to fresh fruit and groceries. You may not have walking access to a school for your children, just because there's not enough population to support these institutions. And so, in hindsight, would it have made sense maybe to, with fair market value, work with community residents to relocate to areas with greater flood resilience within New Orleans and to assemble land to build floodable spaces? Today, again, 20 years hence, billions of dollars put into flood defenses. New Orleans now floods every year, which is a much greater frequency than it was before Katrina. And so this speaks to the experience of many communities today, and we're seeing it play out right now in Los Angeles, about whether rebuilding everywhere is actually in the interest of both those specific neighborhoods that have been devastated and the neighborhoods that surround them.
Who are they to tell me that I need to leave the neighborhood that I love so much?
These questions are coming for us all, because the storms and wildfires and floods will not stop. Brian Stone directs the Urban Climate Lab at Georgia Tech, and he believes that in this age of climate change, emergency preparedness isn't enough. We're going to need a radical new mindset and the courage to ask some really tough questions. Shannon Henry Kiber has her own.
We're at this moment where wildfires and droughts and floods and so many different disasters have become this terrifying but almost regular part of our lives. And you know, even though people come out and say, we're going to rebuild, it's this act of resilience. You've written that rebuilding disaster-prone areas is lunacy. Why do you think it's that much of a bad idea?
So I'll contextualize this in what's ongoing in Los Angeles now, because I think it's pretty salient. 2024 was not only the hottest year of all time, but that we had surpassed this critical threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius that had been established by both the global scientific community and the climate policy communities as kind of the bright line that we did not want to cross. And we've just crossed it. Mm-hmm. And so there are many aspects of this disaster we can look at where preparedness could have been better. But the major issue here is that Los Angeles has not had really any rain since May. It's incredibly dry. We're coming off the hottest year that we've ever experienced. And there really is no way to defend against these kind of disruptive climate events, whether it's wildfires, sea level rise, drought. And so I think we have to give serious consideration to not whether we build back, but where we build back and how that rebuilding not only restores some communities, but enhances resilience for the next event. This isn't specific to California. This is everywhere in the United States.
It's so tough to think about people having to give up their home where they have their culture and their traditions, more practically their job, their connections. How do you tell someone who's in Fort Myers or Los Angeles or New Orleans, you should move somewhere else?
I'm personally not insensitive to this at all. I mean, I fully recognize how challenging this is and that people are grieving right now. They're grieving for the communities and they're grieving for their homes. And in some cases, they're grieving for family members that have been lost. Mm-hmm. So this is the absolute worst time to have a public conversation about how to rebuild and where to rebuild. We have the information we need to know where the highest climate risk zones are today. We already knew that many of these areas that have burned in Los Angeles were the highest risk zone. Some of them had burned before, and we'd already seen private insurers in large numbers pull out of these areas. Mm-hmm. And so that's a really important market signal. Private insurers are unwilling to insure your property really at any premium level, right? I mean, there are people that are willing to pay pretty high premiums to be in these fantastically gorgeous places. But private insurers are saying, we're not interested at any premium rate because the risk is so high. We have kind of new state-supported entities that will do this, but they only do this by spreading the risk amongst those who live both within these high-risk zones and outside of them. And so if those who live outside the highest risk zones are going to shoulder some of the responsibility for the cost of rebuilding, we probably need to have a larger public dialogue about what level of risk we're willing to tolerate.
Do you think it's time to start thinking differently about home ownership? This is the American dream of owning your own home. Is it also your sense of home, that it's where you have been for a long time or it's where you feel comfortable? Do you, you know, how do you get around those philosophical ideas of I could live in another home, I could live in another place?
We don't have protocols for deconstruction. You know, we have been a nation of expansionary thinking, of colonial expansion, frontierism. And we really are running into the limits of that as both a physical process, continual physical growth, because the zone of our habitable land in just the United States is shrinking right now. It's shrinking as the oceans rise. We have less land we can develop, and we're not going to get it back anytime soon. And it's shrinking in terms of our burn zones. We have areas in Arizona, for example, where there's just not sufficient water to support new residential development. And so it's being put on hold. And so the American frontier, like it or not, is physically shrinking. And I think an appropriate response to that is to think about also our cultural traditions about whether we can expect to remain physically rooted in one place for the entirety of our lives. Because climate change for most people is showing up not as hurricane force winds, but as economic disaster. It's the economic brunt of climate change that is probably most threatening to people, more so than, you know, physically getting injured or dying in one of these events, although that happens.
Can you take us through what deconstruction would look like, because I think that is a little unfamiliar to some of us. We know about eminent domain, and there's kind of the attention there of your house has been taken over and you didn't maybe want it to be taken over. But that's not exactly what we're talking about here. This is the moment where something like deconstruction might be a possibility for moving forward.
Yeah. Deconstruction, we can understand that in a couple different respects. Yes, it can be relocating residents and homes in advance or in the aftermath of a disaster. And for some, to relocate in the aftermath and be given fair market value pre-impact is a very viable and attractive option. Again, for many people who might rebuild in LA, I don't know that they'll be able to get private property insurance. That said, I'm envisioning kind of a four-step, and I won't get too technical or academic about it, but I think there are four basic things that we need to bring about planned retreat if we want to pursue this. And the first is just mapping, identifying where the high-risk zones are. We largely have that. You know, FEMA floodplains are widely available, critical for determining whether you need flood insurance, and that's critical for getting a mortgage. So that's a model that's very useful for us. They're not perfect, but it is a federal resource. But we're capable of mapping, whether it's flood risk, wildfire risk, drought risk. We can develop these maps. Once those are established, then we need to determine, well, what are the standards where we would like to see retreat in one zone? And that's really up to communities to play a role in that. And then what are the resources that are going to fund this? And I'll just mention, you know, one of those resources are a new tool that is becoming more widespread, and that's Superfund for a climate disaster. And really having some of the fossil energy companies pay in to help recover from these disasters. And we have several states now that have passed this legislation. And then where we decide it's useful to relocate, we have to assemble the land. We have to relocate the families to locations that have greater resilience and that keep those families whole economically and in terms of community where possible. We have some examples of this. And then last thing, and I think it's really critical, is that if we do acquire land with public funds and relocate families and have them go through that process, it's really critical that this land become not just a levee or a fuel break, but that it's open to public use and becomes an amenity. And so we've seen that, you know, in the aftermath of the campfire in Paradise, California, big fuel breaks that are now public land and they're there for recreation and biking and all kinds of uses. Those are the key steps. It's a framework that we can pursue, but we ideally we would have federal agencies working with state and local governments to do this, but I don't think we're going to have that in the near term. So I think it's critical for states to consider pursuing this on their own.
So the four steps you just went through, it's, you know, I can kind of picture it, but it's really radical. This is a really radical reimagining of the country. How realistic is this? I mean, I think it sounds like a real plan, but is this going to happen?
I think it will happen. We have precedents for this in other parts of the world, but just to respond to the notion this is radical, it is absolutely radical. There's another program I'll mention just because we're on the topic about how to structure a retreat program, and that's from the Netherlands, is a country that is largely below sea level. The Dutch are amazing engineers and over literally hundreds of years have developed infrastructure, even involving their famous iconic windmills that are designed to pump water over levees and drain land and also help control flooding. There were some really catastrophic events, flooding events, one in the 1950s and more recently in the last 20 to 30 years, where the Dutch had just realized that there was no engineering their way out of sea level rise. And so they were going to need to think about whether some levees need to be deconstructed along large rivers and whether some of those levees were actually increasing risk. And we see this in New Orleans too. I mean, if you have the levee there, it signals that this is safe, controlled land and we can develop high densities behind it. And so that's not true when levees fail, when you have really catastrophic rainfall and flooding events. So the Dutch decided in a very famous now plan that translates as room for the river, to acknowledge that the river needed to have an expanded floodplain and that these large levees were narrowing the floodplain and they were increasing the likelihood of flash flooding. So they moved their levees back in many instances by a very long way to expand the natural floodway, the channel, and they had to relocate entire communities to do that. And they gave themselves many years to do it. You know, in this example, communities were not given a choice. They were given fair market value through a process of eminent domain. There were attempts to move entire communities together if that was desired. But it wasn't a choice because it was seen as a critical action to protect the larger communities here. We're having much more extreme flooding events than the Dutch typically in the United States. This program is part of the reason why.
Brian Stone is the director of the Urban Climate Lab at Georgia Tech and author of Radical Adaptation, Transforming Cities for a Climate-Changed World. He was talking with Shannon Henry Kleiber.